Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. You know, I don't know what's behind it, whether it's coincidence or synchronicity, or whether I'm reading too much into a series of events that are completely unrelated, but it sure feels as if aliens, ETs, UFOs are hot. Again, as if they ever went out of style. ETs are back with a bullet, riding a wave of public attention like a surfer on a tsunami. Two big alien movies raking in serious box office right now. This comedy Paul about a road trip that takes a couple of guys to my neck of the woods, Area 51, where they meet this goofball alien. And then there's a big shoot 'em up Battle Los Angeles making big box office. Every week, it seems, some government around the world coughs up a new batch of UFO documents or reports or sets up some new study group. Britain and France, several countries in South America, for example. Various UFO controversies raging right now. Criticisms of MUFON, for instance. New reports of UFOs in and around nuke missile bases that we'll talk about. A lot going on. So who would have predicted that the biggest UFO ET-related story of them all, the one that generated the most media attention by far, is the story of an alien encounter as told by a rock and roll star. Rock legend Sammy Hagar's story of one particular episode from back in his early years, has been all over the news, all over the place, all over the internet. We did our best to get the illustrious Red Rocker on Coast to Coast to talk about it, because this is the one place where he would not get needled or kidded about his experiences, as he's done in other interviews. And there were more than one experience, I guess, that is mentioned in this new book. But we were told that the time just doesn't work for Sammy. You know, maybe we're up too late for him. I don't know. Though judging from everything else that's in this new book, it sure sounds like he's a night owl like the rest of us, maybe more to the extreme. But I wanted to talk about it nonetheless, not because it's all that important of a case, but for the amount of attention it's produced. A UFO sighting by a celebrity, does that help or hurt in taking the topic seriously? Is there something about creative people that makes them more open to paranormal type experiences? And just how many of them have had similar encounters but haven't talked about it? Tonight, a UFO roundtable of sorts. We start with the person I know who has had more celebrity friends, heard more celebrity tales about UFOs and paranormal firsthand, first person, than anyone else I can think of. He's a legend himself, an iconic rock photographer who spent more than 40 years documenting the lives and careers of the biggest names in music. His name is Robert Knight. He's every bit as interesting as the stars he's chronicled, at least in my opinion. A couple of years ago, when I first met him here in Las Vegas, he started telling me some of these stories about rock stars and UFOs, and I thought, wow, that would be a great topic for Coast. Coming up in a couple of minutes, we'll hear those stories from the artist who got all these rock stars to spill the beans about their alien encounters. And then in hour two, I'm joined by two veteran UFO journalists and researchers, Antonio Huneas and Alejandro Rojas. Both have been my guests on the program before. Both have their fingers on the pulse of current UFO research because of their work with Open Minds Productions, which puts out a magazine, has a website, has a radio show. And we have a long list of new and exciting developments in the UFO field to cover tonight. Webmaster Tim Binall and I have, as usual, put together a list of stories from the world of news and science under the banner of Knapp's News there on the Coast to Coast website, including a couple of UFO-related essays. Also there, two items from space.com, including a story about a really interesting project called the 100-Year Spaceship that is just getting off the ground. Also, a report from Siberia about plans by government academics over there to launch a formal study of Yeti, otherwise known as the abominable snowman, sort of Bigfoot's white-furred cousin. Also, there are two environmentally themed news stories, one about the risks and benefits of nuke power, which we've all been reading about because of the terrible events in Japan, versus the risks and benefits of fossil fuels, which we've been using for a century and have caused all kinds of problems. Another one about the health of the oceans. And, you know, if you've listened to the program, it's a topic near and dear to my heart, specifically what is happening to these large predator fish species. We talked about that on a couple of programs last year, and it is not getting any better. And one other item of note on our NAPS News list, it's a story about a mystery earthquake in Florida. And I say earthquake, you have to imagine the invisible quotation marks around that word, because I don't think it was an earthquake. It's kind of this roaring sound that shook parts of Florida for a period of about 20 minutes. Not sure if there's been a solution to this mystery since I first read the story a few days ago, but it certainly is an odd occurrence that you might want to read about. One news item to mention, in case you did not hear this already this evening, Japan was hit with another large quake today, stronger than 6 on the Richter scale. Coastal areas were warned, look for tsunamis. Just what that beleaguered nation needs right now. We're taking a quick break and we'll return with Robert Knight to hear about rock stars and UFOs. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Robert Knight has been photographing rock stars for more than 40 years, but in my view, he's just as every bit as interesting as any of the big names that he has photographed, and he's photographed them all. Led Zeppelin, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Stevie Ray Vaughan, the list goes on, and has somehow got to know them well enough for them to trust him to tell him some pretty intimate secrets, in particular about UFOs and paranormal experiences. And Robert got to meet him a couple of years ago. He's now opened a gallery at the Las Vegas Hilton here in Southern Nevada, and is a really fascinating guy who's got some interesting projects going on. Robert, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thank you very much, George.
Let's start this way, to introduce you to our audience. How is it you became a rock photographer? How is it you became a rock photographer interested in UFOs? And how is it you talked all these big-name stars into trusting you with what could be embarrassing stories?
Well, when I was a young man growing up in Hawaii, I was around a lot of guitar players, and I unfortunately was left-handed and couldn't play the guitar, and I needed to come up with an idea of how to be able to still be in the room with these folks. And I ended up going on a trip to London when I was 16 years old, and there was a movie called Blow Up, had a band in it called The Yardbirds, had a photographer in it starring David Hemmings, and a little bell went off in my head, and I said, I want to become a photographer, and I'll photograph rock guitar players. So I went back to Hawaii, caddied for 6 months in order to buy my first Nikon camera, and basically sat down and said, okay, now how do I do this? And my parents were sort of putting pressure on me to pick a school to go to, and I noticed that Bill Graham in the summer of 1968 basically had everybody booked into the Fillmore that I ever wanted to shoot. So I convinced my parents I needed to go to the San Francisco Art Institute and spent most of my time at the Fillmore. And the very first concert I ever photographed was Jeff Beck, and I think the second was Jimi Hendrix.
That's a pretty good start.
Yeah, and the promoter in Hawaii, Tom Moffat, who, you know, was the main guy there. We became friends, and I saw this band called Led Zeppelin on their opening night in America. I was the first person to shoot them. And I went on to Tom about this band, and I said, Tom, you need to book this band in Hawaii, and he did. And I quickly left the school, went back to Hawaii, and we became fast friends. So that world kind of developed, and Jimi Hendrix came to Hawaii in 1969, and I got to spend some time with him, and I had had a rather unusual UFO sighting as a child, and I had always had a strong interest in it, and he had been writing some amazing songs that kind of indicated something, so I sort of brought the topic up, and he willingly talked about it.
Okay, we'll hear Hendrix's story in a minute, but still keeping with the theme of how you get these guys to spill the beans. After you hear this conversation with Hendrix, and I want you to tell the story, I mean, do you make a point of, hey, I'm going to ask all these rock guys along the way?
Well, I think that, you know, I have a bit of a reputation for being very interested in the topic, so a lot of people actually come forward to me and say, you know, what do you hear? What do you know? And then they share experiences with me. And late as last night, I was having dinner with one of the members of Aerosmith, Brad Whitford, and he told me two amazing stories. So it's like it doesn't take much. If they can find somebody that won't make fun of them and go, you're crazy or you're high on drugs or something, they'll tell you the story. And Sammy Hagar, I had heard this rumor And I actually saw him backstage before a concert here in Las Vegas, and I asked him, and he went into unbelievably lucid details with me and sharing me this most intimate thing that had happened to him, and I was just, you know, I was just startled by it. It was amazing.
I know you told me this story about Sammy Hagar more than a year ago, and, yeah. and here it is making a big news. We've got a clip. We've got a clip from one of his interviews with Howard Stern, I think it is. Yeah. Can we play that now, Jason, and we'll listen to that, and then I want to hear your about your conversation, Robert.
So I'm laying in bed. I feel that, like I'm dreaming that there's these little alien, two guys sitting in a ship up on the hill behind us about 11 miles away, and there's like this, I could see they had something plugged into me. I mean, a wireless thing. I didn't know what to call it, right? Wireless remote.
What did these guys look like?
Like the way a lot of aliens, when you see pictures of them. And they said, oh, he's waking up. They didn't say, you know what I mean? It's all mental telepathy.
Right.
He's waking up. And I felt I was plugged into. Now, I don't know if they were downloading into me now that I know about computers or if they were uploading out of my head into seeing what I knew, you know, like an experiment. And they go, oh, he's waking up. We got to end it. They hollered out some weird numerical code. I mean, like it would not have our numerical system, you know, like 9-11, switching. And I went, whoop, thing was up. And I woke up, my room was white, I couldn't see anything, and it just went pow, black. And I laid there shaking so bad, I mean, it was just really real. And it changed my life, how about that?
Robert Knight, is that basically the story he told you?
Yeah, a little bit more detail, but the thing I want everybody to know is that Sammy didn't put this in a book to sell books, because I think he's wanted to tell this story for some time. I've known about it for some time, and I think this has happened to him more than once. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I got the distinct feeling that he had this happen to him repeatedly through his life, starting when he was really young. He talked about an almost like an umbilical cord sort of stretching between his bed, and he could actually see a ship off in the distance. And, you know, I think, you know, it was just for him, you know, I think these guys have a real open mind. I think musicians and artistic people are much more open to things than the average guy. And I think, you know, he was going with it. I don't think he was exaggerating. I think he truly believed this was happening to him. And I, you know, don't sit there and go, well, I think you're crazy. I absolutely encourage to hear more and more and more. And I've known him a very long time, and I know he wasn't kidding me. You know,
and he said that he wasn't drinking or doing drugs
in
those days.
No, he was actually quite young when it first started, so I think it was sort of pre all of that. I mean, you can tell when someone's, you know, trying to lead you on. But, I mean, Sam was absolutely, you know, livid about this, and he went into great detail. And he actually believed that they gave him information. It changed the way he did things. And it ties very much into what, you know, Jack Vallée has written about in some of his reports and books of people having contact and information going back and forth. And Jacques is a good friend of mine, and, you know, I told him the story of Sammy, you know. I mean, it's amazing, these guys, you know, and I think they're reticent to come forward, but when they can get somebody to listen, they'll tell you.
I wonder if you have a theory about, is it creative people are more open-minded and that's why they see these things, or creative people are more open-minded and that's why they're contacted by some other kind of intelligence?
I think all of the above, George, because if, you know, obviously if you read Vallée and if you read John Alexander's books, the phenomena is real. What it is, that's still up to debate. But obviously they're putting on some sort of human manipulation or some sort of situation where they're influencing people. And I think if you influence musicians, you influence millions of people. If you influence people in television, you influence millions of people. And, you know, I think musicians, artists, creative people are far more open to things and far more open to possibilities. And also, I think they stay up late. I think they look to the skies, and many of the artists that have told me stories have been out late at night, look up into the night sky when it's quiet, and they notice things. And
what does it do? How credible, you know, as witnesses, how credible are they? You know, we read about rock and roll, their lifestyle and substance abuse and things of that sort. Does that make them less credible as witnesses, though?
No, I think, you know, I mean, I think if someone is in some inebriated state and they're going on, but I think that a lot of these people, you know, the party thing is exaggerated. There's a lot of time that they're, you know, very normal people and they go on with their lives. And a lot of these people weren't interested in the topic in the first place, you know, and suddenly this experience has happened to them. And I find those stories more compelling than somebody who spent his entire life looking into UFOs and he sees something. I think when it happens to someone who's not expecting it, those are the best stories.
Well, what do you think about the amount of attention that Sammy Hagar's tiny story in this book has generated? Now, is that what it says probably more about mainstream media than it does about Sammy Hagar, I guess?
I'm not sure. I mean, I've heard a rumor that this book's going to enter number one on the New York Times bestseller list tomorrow. I mean, I went to buy a copy of the book at over at Town Center in Las Vegas tonight, and they said, oh, no, we're back ordered. You can't get your hands on this book right now. So whatever's in that book, it's hitting a topic for the average person because they're flying off the shelves for him. So, and like I said, I don't think he led with this story to sell books. I think it just was an important part of Sammy's life.
You mentioned about the Aerosmith guys. Did you tell me before the program, while we were off the air, they're listening in tonight?
Yeah, I think Brad and Joe Perry are listening. I know Joe Perry sent me an email earlier, and he said he listens to the show all the time. He's on the East Coast, and Brad's in Los Angeles right now. I've been working with Brad's son in a new band that I'm helping develop with another young guitar player named Josh Gooch. So Brad's been in L.A. all week supporting Harrison, and we've had a lot of time to talk UFO stories, and it was fantastic, the stories that he had, you know.
Well, Brad and Joe, consider yourself invited to join us anytime you want to come on the program. At least when I'm hosting, you're certainly welcome. What are the stories that they told?
Well, Brad was talking about an Aerosmith album they were doing in New York City, and there was some form of lunar eclipse or something going on, and took a break, and Brad went up on the roof. I'm not sure if it was everybody in Aerosmith, but to, you know, check out what was going on with the moon. And he said, out of the sky, very low to the horizon, coming very low over the building, was a very large triangle-shaped craft that made no noise. And it was so close, he could see a red stripe down the side of it. And it kind of went off, and it started doing circular movements. And a second craft, identical to the first one, joined it. He said they were circling and circling and then shot off straight up into the sky. So for him, that was a rather, I would consider that a pretty close-in thing with this triangular-shaped craft. Another time, he was down on the beach in Virginia Beach, right near where he lives, and he said he was looking out at the ocean and he saw two lights that looked like stars but slightly larger. They were moving toward him. They came in very close to the shore, and suddenly two became 14. And they were dancing around in the sky, and he said they were leaving light trails behind them. And this went on for some time, and then in mass, they all shot up into the sky. So those were two experiences he had that quite startled him, and he was quite, you know, willing to come forward and talk to me about it.
I should mention to the audience that that you are not just a student of UFOs and ufology, but you really get into this stuff. You know some of the, as you mentioned, Jacques Vallée, but you know some of the leading lights in the field, some of the deepest thinkers in the field, and you really have your fingers on the pulse of a lot of the most foremost researchers, don't you?
Yeah, I've been working with Nick Cook, the fellow that wrote,
Search for Zero Point?
Yeah, Search for Zero Point Energy, and John Stoller, and we've been working over a year and a half on a documentary on psychic Ingo Swann and his entire life and as an artist and as a remote viewer and what he did to the program. And through that, I've met, you know, everybody from John Alexander to Kit Green, Hal Puthoff, Jacques Vallée. I mean, I was able to interview all of them to get their take on everything, spend a lot of time with them, and we've become really good friends. So I feel like I have a good handle on the scientific side, and these are real people with real science in mind, and they have a very open mind, and I know you've had them on as guests, but this has been very helpful, and then a lot of the information that I might learn from them, I will impart back to my rock star friends, and so they'll say, well, what do you hear? What's going on? Like Steve Lukather, they're from Toto, or Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction, they're always asking me what's the latest update, you know, on anything that I might hear in the world that I'm hanging in.
You're going to have to organize some sort of a private conference, rock stars meet UFO scientists or something.
Yeah, I got to tell you, one of the best photos I've ever seen, and I don't mean to out him. There's going to be probably a lot of people bothering him now, but there's a guitar player named Eric Johnson from Austin, Texas, and they were in their tour bus, and the tour manager, 8 o'clock in the morning, came outside the bus, and there was a rather large UFO right over the top of the bus, and he took a picture of it. And Eric showed me this picture of this UFO above the tour bus, and it just absolutely floored me. mean, it was one of the best shots I'd ever seen, and it was in the daytime.
So
and
he's never
trying to get him to use it as an album cover.
Yeah, or at least put it online, let everybody else see it.
Yeah. So.
Oh my gosh. Well, we got a long list of stars. I want to hear their yeah. UFO stories. Hendrix, Clapton, is he on you? I know you photographed him. I just don't know if he had a UFO story.
No, I'm not with Eric. I mean, I haven't had that close, intimate relationship. Jeff Beck's been a really good friend of mine for a very long time, and I remember one time going to his house and saw a Richard Hoagland book, and that kind of opened the door right there, and he had a really big interest on what was going on in Mars. And
all right, hold that thought. Hold that thought. Robert Knight is my guest, talking about rock stars and UFOs. We'll get into some more examples and stories from some of the biggest names in music right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Robert Knight, a photographer who's come to know a lot of these big rock stars, including Jimi Hendrix, Jeff Beck, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Slash. And it's a long, long list of these guys with an interest in UFOs. But it expands beyond just ETs and flying saucers. The story about what happened on Stevie Ray Vaughan's last night and the final photographs taken of him, which were taken by Robert Knight, is a fascinating one. We'll get into that when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Rock photographer Robert Knight is my guest. Robert, I just had a thought during the break that maybe these aliens are coming here because they like rock music. I mean, maybe that's part of the draw. It's one of the resources they don't have back at home, you know, because I do remember we sent Voyager out there with a record that had Chuck Berry on it and other musical selections.
I think it's a universal thing, too. I think music is far more universal than any one language. So I think it would be appealing.
Tell me the Jimi Hendrix.
They had this sort of music dialogue going on there.
That's true. That's right. Tell me the Jimi Hendrix story.
Well, I had actually seen a UFO as a kid in Hawaii, and I was very interested in it. And Jimi Hendrix's albums contained lyrics that indicated that, he talked like he was from another planet and another place and talking about ships in the sky and everything. And as it turned out, he spent a bit of time in Hawaii when they were making the movie Rainbow Bridge, and he actually had seen some UFO sightings up on Haleakala Crater while they were filming. But I brought up the topic to him, and a lot of things that Jimmy said to me, I never really understood until years later. And it wasn't like he was out of it or anything, but sometimes he spoke about things that you really didn't understand. But he kind of felt like maybe he wasn't from this planet. He actually felt he was from another world sometimes. And I think a lot of musicians think that might have been the case, since he played like nobody in this world. But he had a profound interest in that. And I think it was reflected in his artwork and in the lyrics. And there was such a mystical quality to him. They were affecting his music, and he definitely was profoundly interested. But at that time, we really didn't know what was going on. There wasn't a lot of data, or at least we didn't have access to it in the 60s because we didn't have the internet and things like that. So I think a lot of people, it became, we talked amongst ourselves, and it just sort of grew from there. But he definitely was on that path. And I think that also affected a lot of other people, a lot of other musicians that looked into it as a result of it.
You started to tell me before the break about Jeff Beck and his interest in it. Does that interest stem from a personal experience?
Well, a lot of these guys, I have to be careful, but with Jeff, he started asking me about, Richard Hoagland and what was going on Mars and the moon. And it got us into an interesting topic, but one that I never finished if there was personal experience. And then also, Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, Taylor Hawking, his drummer, said, I need to sit down and talk to him. He's a good friend, but, you got a band called Foo Fighters.
Yeah.
They're on Roswell Records, and they did their debut of the album in Roswell, New Mexico. So there's something going on there.
I read that Mick Jagger has had a couple of encounters, that David Bowie, that John Lennon, of course, we know about that instance.
John Lennon. Peter Frampton, a really good friend of mine. I used to spend a lot of time with Peter when he lived in Los Angeles, and I would come up to his house and I would tell him what I know, and we would share experiences. There was a guy named Reg Presley that had a band called the Trogs, which Jimi Hendrix
Wild Thing.
Wild Thing, and he became a very big leader of the UFO community in the UK.
I know I don't know if you ever spent any time with Lennon, but I know you spent time with Ringo Starr. Did the topic ever come up with him?
Well, it was very funny because I knew a very classic Hollywood actor named Stuart Whitman. And Stuart, even though we're not a rock star here, but Stuart was a very big actor at the time in American television with a show called Cimarron Strip. And there was a giant power outage in New York that was very famous, and there was a he ran to the window in his hotel, and there was a UFO right out the window. And they were talking to him in a telepathic manner. And he was, you know, they were talking about ecology, and they were talking about the environment, which at the time was very untrendy. And the next day, Stewart did an interview with the New York Times or somebody, and he brought this up, and it almost single-handedly derailed his career. So he told me that he shared this experience with the Beatles, and that they really liked him. And then, as chance would have it, a few years later, I was doing a photo shoot with Ringo, and I just happened to say, did you ever meet Stuart Whitman? And he, of course, went really ballistic. This was the Beatles' favorite actor, and he started talking about all of their, movies and everything that they had seen with Stuart Whitman in him. And then that UFO story came up in New York. So I know Ringo had an interest in it.
More contemporary artist, Slash. I know you know him pretty well, and I know he had requested a copy of a book that I co-wrote, so I know he has some kind of an interest. Has he had some experience?
He hasn't talked to me about it. He's a really good friend of mine. I saw him a couple days ago in L.A., and, I don't know if anybody knows about this. There's a wonderful documentary that John Chester did on my life and work called Rock Prophecies, and Slash was one of the first guys to come forward, and Jeff Beck, and the Stevie Ray story. I know you were talking about that a little while ago. That's how the film starts, and so if anybody interested in seeing those photos, those final photos of Stevie Ray, they are in that.
Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us the story, because it goes beyond just UFOs and aliens, I think.
Yeah, Stevie and I had become really good friends in 1989 on a Jeff Beck tour, and Stevie was in a terribly bad state before he sobered up, and he was very much, his life was fantastically turned around, and he was very sober and very clean, and we talked a lot about, life and death, and, we became very good friends, and then he called me in 1990 to do a photo shoot with he and Eric Clapton and Robert Cray and his brother Jimmy Vaughn in Alpine Valley, Wisconsin. And it was a two-day affair. And the first day, all the photographers were there, and we were meant to do the shoot. And Eric forgot his clothing, and he said, we'll do it tomorrow. And he said, Robert, don't shoot today. You can have tomorrow to yourself. So I just sat around and didn't shoot anything and talked to Stevie. And we started talking about, life and death. And he said, I have a feeling that I don't have too much longer to go. And I go, why? And he said, I don't know. I have this feeling. But he said, if anything ever happens, nothing you can do about it. And I said, well, did you know Otis Redding died nearby here? And he said, did you know my manager used to manage Otis Redding? And there was all this synchronicity piling up. So the next day, I did the photo shoot, and Stevie, asked me to do this finale number, which was the Jimi Hendrix song and Voodoo Child. And he said, this is for you and me, because this was the same day that Jimmy ever played it the last time or something like this. And while I was doing it, my hands turned to ice, and I almost couldn't hold the camera, and I ran from the stage area. And when he came off, he came up to me and he said, what happened? And I said, look at my arms. They're just like frozen. And he rolled his sleeve up and he said, so are mine. And, there was this really strange sort of thing going on. We both could feel it. And he suddenly said to me, you need to go down this back road. Don't go out this road. Go out this way. And I walked him down to the helicopter, and he knew that he had been a bit morose with me for the last couple of days. And he just said, listen, Robert, if anything ever happens to me, you know me when you hear me. And the next morning I woke up and I found out he was gone. And it just, it was very upsetting. But what makes the story even more interesting is many years later, I'm on the road with John Mayer and Sheryl Crow, and a person that used to work for Stevie, I don't want to say who it is because he's never really come forward, he said, when you were out there shooting Stevie on Voodoo Child, he said, I went into the dressing room and Stevie was in the dressing room. He was sitting there and he talked to me. And he said, I've never told anybody, but I know that you will understand. And so it was happening to more than one of us that night.
And the photo, the final photos, yep. You have them in your gallery here in Las Vegas.
It was the saddest photo I've ever done. People always say, well, what photo, is the most important to you? And for me, it was that picture of Stevie Ray, Eric Clapton, and how happy he looked. And both Clapton and I reflected later, could we have made a difference? If I didn't do that photo shoot, would it have changed anything? But you can't be that way. Life is like every single thing led up to that moment, not just one thing. And so, it's been...
Well, I remember seeing it seemed like there was some weird energy thing around his head, isn't there?
Well, that's another theory. luxuries of photos I have than I call it. Stevie used to sign on his album cover, Soul to Soul. And I have three frames where it looks like his life force, like a piece of energy, comes into his back, and then it comes out his solar plexus, through his stomach, through his forehead, and it just spreads out. And I've shown that to Hal Puthoff, who's a major physicist, and he said it looks like coherent light, and if it was a light leak in the camera, we would have seen it leaking on the edge of the film frame. And I, to this day, can't place what that was, but I call that shot Soul to Soul, and it's just three frames, and I've blown it up 70 inches, and it's just amazing to see this life force flowing through this musician while he was playing.
Yeah, it is a cool shot. Ever hear any stories from Hart? I don't know if you know Ann and
Nancy.
Well,
I know them, but I haven't heard. They're in town, I think, in a week, too. But I got to tell you, the single best story is Steve Lukather, who is the guitar player from Toto. He was driving over Mulholland about 11 o'clock at night after a session, completely sober, and he sees this triangle floating above Mulholland, not very high. And he stops the car, and he gets out, and he's making mental notes. Not making any noise, and it's sort of bobbing like a bobber on water on a calm lake. And he's watching this, and it's slowly moving. And he said all of a sudden all these helicopters came and surrounded it and escorted it off out toward Bell Canyon, where there was a rumor that something went down a few years ago. And I don't know if the two events are connected, but Steve had this fantastic firsthand experience. And he's one of my buddies that just really, go on to the topic whenever we see each other.
Well, that sounds similar to the Cash Landrum case, the yes. Big triangle and the helicopter surrounding it.
Yeah, and then Jennifer Batten, who was Michael Jackson's guitarist and Jeff Beck's guitarist, she told me about 7-8 years ago, she was in Sylmar in her backyard, went to take a break, laid outside, was looking up the sky, and she sees these three lights that formed a triangle shape. And it didn't make any noise, came in over the head, and then shot off, and she said immediately there were three military jets chasing after it. So there was a sort of repeated thing of the triangle shape from the Brad Whitford sighting in New York to the Lukather to the Jennifer Batten. So it's, kind of interesting, that shape.
Hey, we'll take a couple of quick calls, Robert. Yeah. East of the Rockies, Charles in Texas. Hi, Charles.
Yes, gentlemen, if you'll allow me, I've got a very excellent question and a very excellent comment, both on UFOs and rocks, okay?
Don't make it too long. We want to get to some other caller.
Very brief.
Okay.
Have either one of you guys ever noticed Jimi Hendrix's phrasing of what would be just a kind of a bland sentence? He turns it into something mystical. You remember that one line, a broom is wearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life?
Yes.
But he doesn't say it that way. He says, a broom is wearily sweeping up the broken pieces of you. It's like, wow! That's talent right there. That's talent. Also, I can't remember the name of the group, but the group that made We're an American Band.
That was Grand Funk Railroad.
Yeah, Art Bell had them on his show one night, one of the guys from it, and he said they were going to somebody's house, they were having to unlock the back window and raise it up and get inside, and all of a sudden one of the other guys was saying, get out here and look at this, and across the road about 200 yards away was a UFO that was easily a quarter of a mile in diameter, just kind of sitting there at 4 o'clock in the morning looking at them. And as they watch, the whole ground starts vibrating and it shoots straight up and leaves one of those rings that everybody's always talking about. Kind of the smoke ring.
Yeah.
But I always thought that Jimi Hendrix was talented. He could take a simple, bland sentence and turn it into a mystical experience. So.
Yeah, Jimmy was very profound, and his music was so earth-shattering. The first time I saw it, I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know what to think, and it definitely was unearthly.
Charles, thank you for the call. West of the Rockies, James in Montana. Question for Robert Knight.
How are you doing today? It's an honor this evening to talk to both of you.
Thanks for calling.
I was born in 1968, so all the great musicians are dear to my heart and affected my soul. I'd say I'm an Indigo child and have many, many Whitley Stryper type of stories and a very interesting triangle that I drew myself back in junior high. But long story short, you really got around to it. I was wondering how many musicians have actually wrote stories over the years. And you did mention Michael Jackson film crew. a friend of mine is a photographer here in Kalispell, and he was actually the photographer on Michael Jackson's last movie set that never got produced, and has got a fabulous collection of photos. But do you know any stories from Michael Jackson at that point that I could pass on to him? He did say a psychic came and talked to him after Michael Jackson died, because Michael Jackson sent her to him for a reason.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was on the set. He was the photographer for the last movie. But thank you for your time. And thank you.
Thanks, James.
I'll talk to you later.
Robert, we know that Michael Jackson had an interest in this stuff. I think at one point he wanted to build a UFO landing site or something.
Yeah, no, he did have an interest in it. And funny enough, George, I actually had some people approach me, called me, and asked if I knew Michael Jackson and would he be willing to pay $1 million to see an alien body. And I was like, I'm really not sure. And I know they were trying to get to him, and I never did hear the end of that story, but I found it quite unusual that they called me to ask if I could get them connected to Michael Jackson. And as close as I could ever get was Jennifer Batten.
Well, I would guess that he would have paid it, I think, if it was a legitimate offer.
Yeah, I know Jackie Gleason had a tremendous offer, and there were rumors that he got to see something, and when President Nixon was in office, and he saw it down in Florida, and that he actually called his house the mothership. So
yeah, I think he built it shaped like a flying saucer, right?
So, and you know, I think I think all the people in the creative arts are just somewhat open to this, and I think if you just sort of tested the water, a lot of rock stars would have seen this, and we'll talk about it. I mean, you know,
well, we only got a couple of minutes left here, Robert, so I can't get any more calls. But I do want to hear about you said you're working on this project with Nick Cook that became a film. You also have a TV thing going. Are you ready to talk about that?
Nick and I are working on a really cool concept, which is basically a defense journalist and a rock and roll photographer going around the world looking at unusual things. It's not a UFO thing particularly, or we wouldn't be looking at Roswell or anything like that, but we would be looking at things that maybe haven't been covered before. But what we're really working on right now is this documentary on the life and work of Ingo Swann. And I never thought Ingo would agree to do it, because he turns everything down. And Nick Cook called me one day and he said, "Do you think Ingo would allow a documentary to be made?" And I said, "No, but I'll ask." And I called Ingo and he said, "If Nick Cook does it, I'll do it." And so we've been working on it for over a year. We've been shooting. We have about 50 hours with Ingo. And, you know, Ingo has just told us some very profound things. And I know that there were some remote viewing targets that were off-world. He did a book called Penetration. And, you know, he had a very close call and a close incident where he was taken to a northern place and allowed to see something.
That's awesome.
Got a lot of that, you know. And one of the more interesting things that happened, though, there was a remote viewer that Ingo trained that still has his tickets and still works for military intelligence. And he started telling us about a target he did, and he discovered that it was Mars. And when he started telling us on camera about being on Mars and seeing something, a vortex formed above his head and created a mini tornado. And you can see it in the film. It's just swirling around, and the trees and everything are flying. I mean, it was really wild, and we had to stop shooting until this thing would dissipate, and then we started again. So this is the first time this guy's ever come forward, and he's never really, you know, come and identified himself before, but he's in the Ingo documentary. So hopefully we'll get this out soon.
Well, I should tell people I've seen about 20-minute clip out of the Ingo documentary, and I know you're still working on it, but wow, it's great stuff. And you have a target date about when it will come out?
We're talking to some TV people right now, because really what we're trying to do is to get it on the right network. John Stoller, one of our producers, has enabled us to do this thing without the network saying you got to do this or you got to do this. And we've kept it on theme, and we want to make sure that when we get it on the right network that it stays on theme and it doesn't become, you know, the history of remote viewing or something. We really want it to be about Ingo and his work and his writing and the scientific, you know, rap lap that he was, and probably one of the most tested psychics in history.
Yeah, yep.
And
Robert Knight, it's been
accurate.
I enjoy every time we have a conversation, Robert. I really want to have you come back on for a full program sometime, maybe when your Ingo Swann show is ready to go or the TV show. Really appreciate you coming on.
And thank you, George.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Coming, Coming up next, Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Joneas, sort of a roundtable discussion about a variety of UFO events and stories breaking around the world. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM.